Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Laura Lee. One of the joys of this job over the past 12 years has been hearing from so many researchers in so many different fields to hear in depth their piece of the puzzle that they've been researching, and I sit in a great position here to see pieces being put down on the table in various sectors and then how all of this grand design fits together, especially in the field of ancient mysteries. Another joy is when some of those researchers get together on this show, and we'll have one such occasion here tonight, three of them. Two of them have met before, almost on the show. They were, I think, next to each other in the guest lineup one night some years ago. That was Stephen Naylor and Chris Dunn. Stephen has been doing work with the indigenous elders of the Giza Plateau, the keepers of that very old line of wisdom, and looking at the underground waterways, long rumored. Finally, the evidence has come in to confirm that. And his new book is called
The Land of Osiris.
Just out. And Chris Dunn, a longtime frequent guest on this show, joins us again tonight, and his work has been looking for the power source. When Paul and I went to Egypt, we saw lots of evidence of machine tooling. We're not machinists like Chris Dunn is, but even we could recognize the artifacts in the pyramid there, in the museum there, that these were extraordinarily done, not with pounding balls. There was some tools going on there, on beyond copper. These were machined. We could see that. So quickly found out about Chris, invited him on the show, and Chris's book, The Giza Power Plant, explains just how the power source might have been to power some of those tools. Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm fine, Laura. It's a pleasure to be back talking to you.
Good to be back to you. And I understand you and Stephen met and have been collaborating for some time, and you found John Cadman, who's a maritime engineer, who also joins us in our four-way conversation here, and John has built a working model of a pump to explain how you get water from deep underground up to the Great Pyramid to then start doing who knows what, and we're going to try to sort some of those pieces out. John, how are you, and thanks for being here.
Hi, Laura. I'm doing really well. It's nice to be here.
So where do we begin with this story? Stephen, you're in studio.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you. And you deserve a lot of the credit in this first section because, as you mentioned, I became aware of Chris Dunn's work perhaps in the mid-1990s. I think it was an article in Atlantis Rising that he had written on advanced machining. And I met a friend of yours at a conference in Newark, Delaware, arranged for me to be on a show in November of 1996 with you. And lo and behold, synchronistically, on the same night, you were interviewing Chris Dunn. And that's the first time I ever heard him speak, and I was very impressed with him and his work. And another synchronistic event, we were invited to be on a closed-circuit TV show in Santa Barbara, California, in February of 1997, and that's where we first met. And it was like an instant coming together. I mean, it's like we knew each other in past lives, if people want to go there. And it's just been, since then, we've become great friends and colleagues. And how it all becomes full circle here is Chris was invited to be a director of research of an organization that's formed by Dr. John DeSalvo, who you have interviewed, called the Great Giza, the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association. And I then contacted John DeSalvo, and I became a director of research. And he said there was a gentleman that came along on board to be part of an advisory board, and that's John Cadman. And so that brings us all together. We are all on the advisory board of the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association. That's GizaPyramid.com, and now I've come here to a vacation to the Seattle area and have met John, and so now it's all come to circle. And Chris and I have gotten to the point where we've actually done a tour of Egypt together, so we've been in the field in May of 1999, and that's a fantastic adventure to be in the field with Chris Dunn, to be out there and see things through his eyes, to see him point out the machining, to see him point out the artifacts, and our combination of events that I am a prehistorian, archaeologist, theorist, and I have provided the cultural context, the greatest criticism that's been applied to a lot of the theories of alternative researchers and Chris's work, is there's no cultural context. Where is the culture that could have produced advanced machining or advanced civilization? And through my work with the indigenous elder, Abdel Hakim, we now have the cultural context that there was a a civilization prior to 10,000 years ago of indigenous people, very sophisticated, highly advanced in science, mathematics, and engineering. And so there's the framework that brings Chris's work out. And Chris's book, The Giza Power Plant, is the first major work that fits right in line with the indigenous teaching.
And John, you're building a working model of Kunkel's pump. I've also been intrigued by the Kunkel pump theory. Now, what's the update on that? Because I kept asking, Stephen Myers, you guys going to build a working model? You know, isn't it easy to put a few things together and get the angles right and get this and see if it works? And I understand you finally done that.
I put it together. Actually, it's been running for about 2 years, a little over 2 years. And there were some parts of it which were really quite difficult to overcome, and one of the biggest things would be that there's very few good designs of the subterranean chamber, which is
a key part of this.
Yes, it is.
And Chris notes that in your book, Chris.
Yes. In the Giza power plant, the subterranean chamber, I theorize, actually held equipment that drove the pyramid, the entire pyramid, to resonance, and in assistance with some of the other pyramids, actually drove the entire plateau to a vibratory resonance. And what that equipment looked like, I have no idea. I mean, one can speculate, but certainly somebody who actually develops a system, and I believe John has developed a system, and John, you can override me if you want. I don't want to speak for you.
Yeah, I actually, back in 99, I had read Chris's book, and had come across part of what his theory was regarding the subterranean chamber creating the pulse or the pulsing frequency to drive the upper part of the pyramid, something of a Tesla sort of nature. And in April of 2000, I finally built a working model of the basic pump assembly of the descending passage in the subterranean chamber. And the one thing I had noticed was that the subterranean chamber was absorbing the vast majority of a hydraulic hammer or a compression wave. And it was sending.
Can you explain what a compression wave is in a hydraulic hammer?
Hydraulic hammer is an effect which occurs when moving water is stopped nearly instantaneously. Basically, the near instantaneous closing of a valve, and when that occurs, the water, which is moving at a certain speed, stops instantaneously. And when it does that, it compresses the fluid at the valve area, and it basically reflects back up from the water source. And what I had found was that the subterranean chamber, when it was absorbing the vast majority of this compression wave, and the compression wave is has a tremendous force. I've calculated it out to be something in the neighborhood of 21 million pounds of force, vertical force in the subterranean chamber. So it's a sizable force.
So how difficult would it be to accomplish that? Because that subterranean chamber is very odd. It's rough cut. It's got some sort of wall between it. It looks, and so many people have guessed, there's got to be a very specific purpose to this, but it doesn't look like any technology we're used to seeing. So would it be by specific design to do that? How difficult is it to accomplish that, what you're talking about?
It was a very, very difficult design in that it's very much a three-dimensional design, and not only does it incorporate fluid dynamics, It also incorporates acoustical dynamics.
Oh, how so? Can you both explain all three? Explain that a little more.
Of course, that leads right into Chris's work when you say acoustical dynamics. So go ahead, Chris.
Well, I'm not going to steal John's thunder because, you know, the acoustics, if you look at any sound traveling through any medium, it is vibration. We know it as sound when it strikes our ears. But really, it's a wave that is traveling through a medium,
whether it's through
water
or air.
Or a solid or a liquid.
Okay.
So the properties of the medium and also the dimensions that the medium is contained within would affect the characteristics of the sound or the vibration.
Why is it important to set up a vibration there, and what could it do?
To set up a vibration in the subterranean chamber could potentially cause the entire pyramid to, if that vibration is pulsed at the resonant frequency of the structure, then the structure will absorb that energy, and it will maximize the throughput of that energy through the structure. So when you talk about, say, a harmonic resonance, you can actually, it's like a piano strings, where you strike one and at an octave higher, another string will vibrate in sympathy. It maximizes the absorption of energy.
Because if you map out a resonant bunch of frequencies, the lows all match up, the highs all match up, and so they're building. That was Tesla's whole principle. If you get them to match up,
exactly,
you build up strength.
Basically, what I was leading to was that Tesla actually demonstrated the effect of this phenomenon. And
creating the earthquake in New York.
Built an earthquake, an earthquake machine, right.
You think, what can a few sound waves do? Well, quite a lot if you engineer it correctly.
Right, and so it's like, if you take a huge one-ton iron ball that's hung from a chain from the ceiling, you go up to it with you'd calculate how much energy is going to take to move that ball from point A to point B, say a 3-foot swing. And so you calculate how much energy it takes to overcome inertia and move that mass. You could have a considerable amount of energy involved in the hammer that you're going to use to strike it. However, a child could walk up to that huge ball and just give it a little push, and it won't move very much, but it will move, and then it will move back to her, and then she can push it some more. And so every time the pendulum swings back to that child and a energy is applied to it, the ball will swing further. And so with less energy, you can actually affect a greater amount of work by moving the ball further than what you normally could if you were just going to strike it.
There's other indications that resonance was part of the mechanics of the solid-state machine, as you've described it, Chris, because the King's Chamber is so set for particular resonance. There's so many indications that it was...
And I understand, too, that you recently had an acoustics engineer, John Reed, on your...
John Reed, fascinating work.
Yes.
He stretched a drum across the sarcophagus. He set up tones.
Yes.
And he found hieroglyphic shapes forming in the sand, a la Hans Jenny's cymatic experiments.
And I haven't... I'm going to buy his book from your bookstore, but I'm fascinated to read his work.
Yeah.
Because I know that in my book, in the I think from what I read on your website, that he noted that the whole chamber resonated at around 440, and also the granite box. So I call it a granite box. A lot of people call it a sarcophagus.
Which is a misnomer.
But that they resonated at 440.
So you have this other chamber above that's geared to accept resonance and a particular frequency and do interesting things with it. We'll get to that in a moment. But you mentioned that it's pulsing at a resonance frequency. And, John, how does the pulse happen? Does this valve close on and off so that you get a pulse? Because it's very important to set up a resonance, right?
Right. Yeah, the valve opens and closes after the initial opening of the valve, which would have been down somewhere in front of the sink, kind of the Lake Hath or the Nile. Once that valve is opened, it starts to pump assembly starts to run up by itself. It takes over.
How does that happen?
It has to do with the initial compression wave, and right after the compression wave, there's a rarefaction wave.
Uh-huh.
Which
rarefaction wave? You want to explain that?
Which is basically the opposite of a compression wave. It's a negative pressure wave. It directly follows the compression wave. But when that rarefaction wave leaves the valve area, it actually reopens the valve, and
okay.
So it's ready to eventually have water pass by it and close it again.
How does it get pulsed at a particular frequency, so it's beat, beat, beat? Is it to do with the size, the materials, the opening, the initial setting?
That's a very interesting question. That it has a lot to do with everything you said, the size of the valve, the material of the valve, the amount, the distance that the valve moves, and whichever surface that it strikes, has everything to do with all those. But what I found is that in the subterranean chamber itself, it was designed by way of the room's height being a split level room. Half of the chamber would resonate at 440 hertz. And then the other half would be 880 hertz, which is double the 440.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. So coordinated with the King's Chamber.
Yes, it is.
And I saw a working demonstration today of John's model, and I was very impressed. And I think the pulsed frequency is very important. In fact, Teresa, my lady, commented that when he first turned it on, it sounded like a heartbeat.
Boy.
And it puts out a tremendous pulse. The model that I have has a schedule 40 PVC pipe, which is a semi-flexible sort of pipe that's used in the passageways. And in the full-scale model on the Giza Plateau, that would have been incorporated solid limestone, which is very non-flexible, and the amount of pulse, the hammer effect, would have been just tremendous. This particular model will very easily, I know it would shake the whole pyramid all by itself without having to multiply the deep pulses.
So the PCV pipe being flexible absorbs some of the effect, but the granite, obviously, rock solid, wouldn't.
Right.
How big is your working model?
It's on a scale of 1 to 48, so it's a quarter inch of the foot. I have the subterranean chambers about 6.5 inches by 11 inches.
How would you model the subterranean chambers? It's not like you have a recipe like you could do with the King's Chamber.
I went mainly by Petrie's measurements and a lot of photographs.
A lot of irregular surfaces there.
Yes.
Was that so important, or was it just the basic dimensions of it that's important in the material?
The irregular surfaces are also critical in that they create a really complex three-dimensional water flow, which...
Oh, with a lot of eddies and whirlpools and
absolutely.
That kind of thing. Uh-huh. So just like in our studio, we put baffling on the sides of the walls to absorb the sound, so it's not bouncing around in a small chamber. Would that have a similar effect, a baffling effect, the irregular surface?
It has a lot to do with the fluid dynamics as opposed to the acoustical dynamics.
Uh-huh. Fluid dynamics, you're a maritime engineer. This is something you've studied. Give us a bit of insight on that.
The way they've channeled all of the various flows, the fluid flows, within the chamber, an instance is one of the flows, which is comes from the channel. There's a channel it's the middle of the step area within this subchamber. The flow that comes out of that actually redirects another particular flow so that it minimizes erosion
stable.
Complex flow design.
Wow. Where would the water come up? Because, Stephen, you've written about these waterways. We've seen evidence of the tunnels big enough to walk in, tunnels that were highly engineered, a vast system of tunnels, plumbing under the Great Pyramid.
Absolutely.
Bringing in, where would it meet up with the subterranean chamber?
Well, John and I were talking about this earlier. There happens to be a chamber entrance that goes into the subterranean chamber, which, of course, the Supreme Council of Antiquities has put a lock on and a gate. Drumbel and Melchizedek has spoken about this. I believe that tunnel is coming from the Sphinx. So as John has mentioned...
valve would be at the Sphinx.
Yes, and probably from Lake Hathor, as he mentioned. We know that the Sphinx sits in her own hollow. It was hollowed out when she was carved, and the blocks used to build the structures in front of the Sphinx. So Hakim has always mentioned that once the Sphinx was completed, she sat on a waterway on her own lake. So, and with the underground tunnels and that water system, we believe that's where it's coming in. And I think John's model will eventually show that.
Aesthetic technology.
Yes.
Looked pretty while it sat there doing its job.
Absolutely. All functions at once.
Yeah. Chris, do you want to add to this?
Well, I would be interested in it. I'm jealous of Stephen for actually seeing the model. I'd like to see it myself.
We have to get you here.
Yes, certainly. And, you know, what? Basically, I guess if we could look at the... what John has done and how you introduced him, Laura. I know that you introduced John and his work as being a Kunkel's pump.
Clarify that.
Yeah, and I was under the impression that, that John's work has diverted somewhat from Kunkel in terms of how he explains the upper chambers. Is that correct, John?
Oh, that is so correct. Yeah. It has very, very little to do with Kunkel's work. In fact, I had originally tried Kunkel's design, and in my model, it didn't work.
But interesting that Kunkel got onto water and pump, even though he didn't get it right.
Yes, I give him credit for that. He definitely introduced the whole design.
And I always thought water shooting out the top of the pyramid was rather absurd.
I thought it was quite absurd.
Yeah.
And it doesn't explain all the other evidence in the upper chambers.
Yeah.
So that's what I had a problem with.
So you went back to the basic designs of the Great Pyramid and said, now how would this translate into a working pump? Tell us that process, John.
Oh, my. I actually had just done the subterranean section, and so you could eventually remove the whole pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And what I had found was, I'd originally left off the well shaft. I'd originally believed that had been added after the pyramid had been running.
The well shaft, could you?
The well shaft being a shaft leading from the bottom of the descending passage up to the junction of the ascending passage and the horizontal passage at the Queen's Chamber. And it was just a very strange shaft, which has, some people believed it was built as an inspection shaft or for removing people or all sorts of odd explanations. After studying the subterranean chamber for an extended amount of time, probably 8 to 10 months, I finally realized that the pit, which is a kind of a square shaft that drops about 11 feet down in the floor of the subchamber, that it had originally extended down further, and that pit shaft extended out to an area somewhere around the Sphinx, which coordinated nicely with what the indigenous teachings said about there being a tunnel from the Great Pyramid up to the Sphinx area. So I tried that basic layout and assumed that the dead end shaft, which it's a 2 foot square shaft that leads 57 feet into Never Never Land, well, it just stops abruptly. That the flow had exited through the dead end shaft. And the original model incorporated that particular design, and around all the pyramids, it's pretty accepted that there was a retaining wall of some form.
Mm-hmm.
That's relatively, I mean, it's even accepted by the Orthodox camp.
And what were those walls retaining?
Yes. So I had to agree with Kunkel that the retaining walls had something to do with retaining water, and the walls would have to be approximately 60 feet high to allow water to drop down into the descending passage.
Well, a couple questions, and then let's get back to piecing together what this technology might have been. So many people are looking for a hall of records under the Sphinx, and unless they used waterproof containers, it seems that there were some very different uses for those chambers then, would one assume?
Well, if I could address that, when I first spoke about a hall of records to my teacher, Abdel Hakim, maybe 1997, he poo-pooed the whole idea. He didn't support the idea of a hall of records. And basically he said that we are the hall of records.
Mm-hmm.
He said the memory of who we are and what we were before is encoded in our DNA, as Greg Braden says, and that we only have to wake up to this knowledge. So he was not supportive of the fact. Now, it doesn't mean that there may not be a chamber under the Sphinx that may have some evidence. I don't think it will be papyrus scrolls, as people tend to think.
The very technology.
Exactly. I think it will be some of the evidence that Chris is talking about. I think they're going to be schist plates. They're going to be a stonework that's going to be part of the apparatus of the machines that were used. But Hakim's emphasis to me has been since the beginning of our work that the majority of the tunnels under all the sites, not just on the Giza Plateau, I speak of many sites in my book, which we call the Land of Osiris, all connected by tunnels, were primarily to bring water to the sites for energy.
It's interesting that in Mexico, at Teotihuacan, there was also waterways and lakes, man-made ponds, you know, whatever, around the pyramids of the sun and the moon, one wonders.
We think, again, I speak of what we call the global maritime culture, which existed over 10,000 years ago. As previous guests that you've had, David Hatchett Childress and Gunnar Thompson, have said, the oceans were highways, not barriers. So I think a lot of this knowledge was shared around the world. It was not just exclusive to one people.
We need to take a break, and we'll come back with Stephen Naylor, who's in studio. And on the phone, we have John Cadman, maritime engineer, who's built this model. Stephen's seen it. Supports perfectly Chris Dunn's work, also on the telephone, who has proposed that when you bring this water up into the pyramid, the rest of the pyramid is part of the solid-state machinery that could take water and turn it into some form of energy. We'll be right back. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.
All interviews on The Laura Lee Show are available on audio cassette. For information, call 1-800-243-1438.
The Laura Lee Show is brought to you by the following sponsors. Udo's Choice Wholesome Fast Food Blend. Udo's Choice Wholesome Fast Food Blend contains 50 phytonutrient-rich whole foods, whole food concentrates, vegetables, herbs, providing protein, essential fats, minerals, vitamins, and fiber, along with enzymes for ready digestibility. Add to vegetable juice, oatmeal, porridge, yogurt, applesauce, or soups, and can be sprinkled on virtually any food. Call 1-800-243-1438. 1438 for a special offer on Udo's Choice Wholesome Fast Food Blend. Or for links for more information, go to radiobookstore.com.
Hard to believe that an herb has the power to kill bacteria, viruses, and other pathogens, but the wild oregano growing in the Mediterranean does just that, and as effectively as prescription drugs. Numerous laboratory experiments demonstrate this power, yet oregano is safe and gentle on the body. North American Herb and Spice produces the finest, the purest, the most potent line of oregano products, Oregamax, Oregasin, and Super Strength Oil of Oregano. Read about the numerous lab studies, how to use oregano, and what it can do to protect your health against a wide range of common pathogens and parasites. It's all at oregamax.com. You can also call them direct at 800-243-5242 to place an order or find a store nearest you for your oregano products. A wild oregano, the most potent herb ever tested, yet gentle and safe. It's a great and wonderful gift of nature, and you can call 800-243-5242 and visit oregamax.com. Did you know enzymes are needed for each and every of the millions of biochemical reactions in our body? Past the age of 30, our body's natural production of enzymes slows down. That's why we need to supplement. I take Vitalzyme. It's the most complete and effective blend of enzymes with protease, serrapeptase, papain, bromelain, amylase, lipase, rutin, and amla. What did these enzymes do? They help so many vital functions. To balance our body's own repair mechanisms, regulate the formation of fibrin, cleanse the blood of debris, promote good blood circulation, maintain immune system health, and much, much more. Vitalzyme contains no animal derivatives, no artificial flavors or colors, and no talc, lactose, yeast, or gluten. For your supply of Vitalzyme and a free cassette of Dr. Will Wong's Systemic Enzyme Therapy, call World Nutrition at 800-548-2710. That's 800-548-2710. Let's continue with our conversation with three Egyptian researchers putting some very interesting pieces of this puzzle on the table. That would be Stephen Mailer, his book, The Land of Osiris, available at the Radio Bookstore. We have Chris Dunn, his book, The Giza Power Plant, also available at the Radio Bookstore. Another researcher we want you guys all to meet is John Reed over in England. We'll put you in touch. His book, Egyptian Phonics, also plays into this. And that book is exclusively available at the Radio Bookstore. And we have John Cadman. And John, we hope you make a videotape or some documentation of this, of your work and its implications. And John also joins us. So just a point about water. Whales communicate by setting up resonant frequencies that travel if they can get the specific temperature and depth. It can travel miles across the oceans. So my point being that water is a very good medium for certain types of waves to propagate, and with a lot of force. They don't lose, it doesn't lose energy like sound waves do through the air as much. Am I correct, Chris?
I was going to say that's so correct.
Oh, good. You're the
I would agree with that.
Okay.
I was hoping that John, would, being the maritime engineer, would field that question.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I meant so, can't see either of you guys, okay? But I can hear you. So tell me a little bit about that. And if you were going to build such a machine, this is water's a very good way to deliver some of the oomph of the whole machinery, right, John?
Yeah, it would be similar to transferring of electricity through copper wires.
Okay.
Transfer a compression wave, which is a really extremely powerful force, through a water tunnel. So it's a very efficient way to transfer energy.
Because you can do a lot with very little. I was asking our friend Gary Hawkins, who told us about Brown's gas years ago. You take some water and you separate out the gas into oxygen and hydrogen. I'm going, Gary, how much of electricity do you need to do that? He said 1 or 2 volts. I said, well, the clay jar batteries we were just talking about, they produce 0.5 volt each. He said, oh, yeah, you can hook a bunch of those up together. You can get your several volts. That's all you need to make this stuff. I'm going, okay, it could have been done, right?
And that's true.
Possibly. I mean, if you're clever, you don't need a lot to do a lot of work.
Right.
I mean, you can use simple materials.
Well, I think that the evidence clearly shows to me, anyway, that the ancient Chemetians, or Egyptians, were very, very skilled in their technology, very knowledgeable, and that the system that they built at Giza was what I would consider to be a very holistic system in terms of transferring one kind of energy to another kind of energy. And the work that John is doing in introducing water into the equation, which was something that I had not really considered, makes more sense to me as I think about it, because it is, water would impart more force on the structure than just a sound wave moving through air. So, you know, I applaud him for his effort and his enthusiasm, especially in actually building a working model.
John, because water weighs so much more than air, and so it can push better and can, you know, push against the sides of the granite and set up that resonant frequency better, or what? What is the qualities here?
Air is compressible, and water, most fluids are just slightly compressible. And so when if there was air within the subterranean chamber, then it wouldn't transfer compression waves well, or it wouldn't work.
Oh, it would go really towards compressing the air that's in the chamber rather than pushing against the granite.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that was one thing that Kunkel had originally said, was that the subterranean chamber was some sort of air compression chamber.
Wrong.
And the evidence just does not support that. There's significant water erosion throughout the chamber, and it demonstrates that it was completely water saturated.
What are the signs of the water erosion in that subterranean chamber?
There's a lot of wear.
Mm-hmm.
So it shows that it did run, and it did run for a significant period of time.
Would that be one reason why it was discontinued or got out of whack when enough material was taken away out of the chamber? Did it get less accurate?
I really couldn't say.
I don't believe so.
From what I've seen from Chris's work and what I've encountered, that it had something to do with the upper chambers.
And some explosion probably derailed it.
And actually, Chris was the first one to postulate this, and I have gone back since Chris's book has come out and checked in the Grand Gallery and in the King's Chamber, and I am totally in support of Chris's idea that some sort of accident explosion occurred in the Great Pyramid. And Chris, you could elaborate on that.
Yes, there's quite a lot has come to the surface, Laura, since we talked, in terms of additional research and also vindication for some of the proposals that I made in the Giza power plant. One was the location of the what I called resonators in the Grand Gallery, which explained the existence of the slots that were in the ramps that run on both sides of the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And I postulated that these resonators there was 27 banks of resonators that were actually tuned to the frequencies coming through the pyramid.
So they transferred the resonance from water to air?
They transferred from the limestone to air.
Right.
Okay, gotcha. Oh, I see.
One thing I'd like...
Water to limestone to air. Okay. Go ahead.
I'd like to add is that the water, the highest point it would have gone would be to the floor of the Queen's Chamber. And that'd be the total elevation of any water within that structure. So it has very little to do with the actual Queen's Chamber or King's Chamber.
Gotcha. Okay.
So the proposal that I made was the destruction of the, or the, what caused the Great Pyramid to shut off was a catastrophic failure that caused an explosion within the King's Chamber. It caused some of the noted phenomena that we find in the King's Chamber, such as the walls being expanded over an inch. normally, in an earthquake, things collapse. They tend to fall in on themselves. They don't expand. Also, the giant granite beams, of which there are five layers above the King's Chamber, were caused to crack along the south end. I also proposed, and those were actually observed by previous researchers, and they're available in books by Howard Vyse, Peter Tompkins' book, Piazza Smythe's book, Our Inheritance of the Great Pyramid. So these were all noted phenomena by early researchers. What I proposed was also that it has been long speculated that within the Grand Gallery there were certain pieces of equipment or there were certain devices, and the question was, what happened to these devices? We know that early explorers coming into the Great Pyramid were faced with a tremendous amount of rubbish that they cleared out. A lot of stone was dropped down the well shaft. A lot of stone was dropped down the descending passage and eventually had to be cleared out in later years. But what I speculated was that the explosion that occurred actually caused the destruction of these resonators in the Grand Gallery. And by a tremendous fire that caused them to burn up, and that there would be evidence that would support that. Well, when I was in Egypt in 1999 with Stephen, we were inside the Grand Gallery, and it was only when we were doing some video inside the Grand Gallery, and it was only when they actually turned on the camera lights that I noticed on the wall a tremendous scorching on the walls of the Grand Gallery. And they were on each overlap. As you know, in the Grand Gallery, they have what they call a corbelling, where the walls step in about an inch and a half per side as they reach the ceiling. They go from 82 inches wide at the bottom to 42 inches wide at the top, and that's over a 28-foot height. That each of the steps that comes in as you look up the gallery wall towards the ceiling, there were these scorch marks and places where you could see that the stone was clearly burned and scorched, and in some places it actually flaked off.
And if I could interject, Chris, you also discovered in May of 1999 that the upper wall of the Grand Gallery is granite, not just the King's Chamber, and these scorch marks are in granite.
That's correct, yes. And as you get close to the King's Chamber, there is a transition of material from limestone to granite. That every piece of literature that I had read prior to observing that did not refer to any granite being in the Grand Gallery.
Right.
So that was new to me, and that was quite an exciting discovery. But more exciting to me,
yeah,
was that right over the slot, if you take a straight line mm-hmm. down the wall and take that line through each of the scorch marks, it landed right in the slot on the ramp on the gallery floor. So whatever burned, whatever caused that vitrification, that scorching on the stone, was oriented in the Grand Gallery over the slot in a vertical orientation, which is precisely what I had illustrated in my book. And the next observation that I made actually came 2 years later. It was last year, after they had closed the pyramid for a year and they had done some cleaning. And I know there were a lot of rumors on the internet that was just a ruse. But indeed, when I went into the pyramid, I noticed that they had done a considerable amount of cleaning inside the Great Pyramid. Mm-hmm. And what that cleaning had revealed on the ceiling of the Grand Gallery were scorch marks on the ceiling,
mm-hmm.
on both sides of the gallery, and in just the places where you would see the support structure of the resonators that I had illustrated in my book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have those photographs up on my website. So listeners can go to www.gizapower.com and click on the links. I have several articles up there, updates since my book was published, so they can read about that material and also look at the photographs.
Okay, a couple of questions. So these resonators would be made out of some flammable material?
Well, there's speculation that they're actually crystal, and it could have been such tremendous heat or the explosion that destroyed them completely.
This ties into my second question. Edgar Cayce talks about the Atlanteans having a crystal that goes out of whack, and my earlier question about maybe so much material came out of the subterranean chambers to start the resonance being a little bit off, therefore that it wasn't quite in resonance with the King's Chamber. Would that be enough over time to throw the whole thing out of whack so then it could start to, you know, would that be enough to create explosion? What would? Sabotage? What can you imagine, Chris, that would create such an explosion?
Well, what I believe created it was a meteor strike, because the damage that we see in Egypt is not just inside the Great Pyramid. We see it all over Egypt, at the Pyramid of Meidum, at Saqqara, at Abu Ghraib, Abu Rawash. There are signs that there was a tremendous destruction. And I'm going to explain why I believe that it was an outside force or an external force that caused this destruction.
Hmm.
Because we have a system that relies on earth energies to operate. It maximizes the throughput of energy from the earth. Now, when we're working with a closed system, such as, you know, our ecology, our environment is a closed system, and we have a system that's maximized to have throughput or energy from that system, and then there is an influx of energy.
Yeah.
The system that we have should be, if it can't transfer that energy or move that energy away, in a rapid manner, then it's liable to just destroy itself. It becomes what they call a runaway vibrator. It can't handle the energy that that is being pumped into it.
And so would it create an explosion of that magnitude? Would it create?
Well, I think then what you have to look at is a probably a chain of events.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the systems or the device, the Great Pyramid device, as I call it, the machine, if you would have certain devices that work on the outside of the pyramid as well as the inside, because we're working with a gas within the pyramid that is also in harmonic resonance with the pyramid, with the earth, with the universe. We're talking about hydrogen gas, a very flammable gas. Because we're working with that kind of gas, the introduction of oxygen into the system, sparks that would set it off, would cause a huge explosion. So when we look at a chain reaction, we see that there is a huge influx of energy. The pyramids, being so finely tuned to the frequency of the earth, cannot handle that energy. And so they literally start shaking apart. With the Great Pyramid, whatever equipment is located on the outside to contain the gases and make the system work is shaken off. And so then we have an introduction of gases into the system, into the pyramid. From there, you have another chain reaction on the inside with an explosion. The chamber is expanded over an inch. The vitrification inside the King's Chamber, the vitrification in the Grand Gallery, all of these...
Discoloration of the stone box.
Exactly, the discoloration of the stone box. Thanks for bringing that up, Stephen. All of these things were part of this chain reaction when the disaster struck.
So how would you make a computer model or some sort of, I can't really see a working model with this, but how, you know, have you gone to physicists and said, working with these gases and these properties of resonance and pulsing and all of that, how far have you looked into this to see what gases, what combination, what were they doing with it? How do you turn that into some sort of usable power for the machine tools that left their mark on all of those artifacts?
Right. The computer modeling, of course, is outside my capabilities. I don't have the resources to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I have been in communication on several occasions with different people who have expressed an interest. Unfortunately, nothing has panned out yet for one reason or another.
But you're open to somebody coming forward and saying, this is my field and let me...
I just want somebody to come forward and say, okay, you know, I believe in this. I think we could model this. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to be very time-consuming. It's going to be expensive because of the computer hardware and software that you would need to do it. Though I believe that our PCs are becoming so powerful now that a lot of the modeling software could run on a PC.
And wouldn't it be nice if we lived in a country or a climate in which alternative energy, which makes so much sense these days, were one of our goals? And company swooped down and said, hey, we're looking for R&D ideas. We've got plenty of funds, plenty of folks to work on this. We need a working model to save the world. You know, we'll try anything, see how far we get.
Well, you can be sure if it has a military application, they're already working on it.
Well, that's a good point.
Well, we know, some people tend to think when we talk about anti-gravitics or things like this, a lot of people poo-poo it, but the fact is that the government's been working in anti-gravitics research for 30 or 40 years. And so this is something that has, and again, if it has some sort of military application, they're interested.
Yeah. So, John, what do you think? You're an engineer.
About
Chris's description of the rest of the
I agree with him totally.
Because?
Because it makes sense with what evidence is there.
Yeah.
Chris goes by evidence, and that is something I really appreciate.
If I could comment on that, and thank you, John, I appreciate that. What I have said in my book, and I still maintain, is that John will understand, as an engineer, that any time you propose a device or a machine that will perform useful work, you cannot come right out of the box with a perfect working model. There's always development. There's R&D. Something doesn't work. You have to try something else. And so I have never been, a real hard-nosed stickler that says that my ideas are the only ones that are correct. I think that basically if there is a different view, then it has to explain the evidence. And because we're looking at the pyramid as an entire system, everything has to fit within the same context. And that's where Egyptology has failed, in my opinion, because every explanation for every feature is a forced theory.
Right.
Yeah. Well, what's beautiful about this design that you're describing is that they bring the water up, and we see the tunnels for that, and big tunnels. Why else would you need such big tunnels? There's so many of them. And then the water is a great medium, John, as you were pointing out, for delivering powerful resonant waves.
Right.
And then also the material. I'm assuming you're talking about separating the water into hydrogen and oxygen, right?
Right. There's some evidence which would strongly suggest that that was one thing that occurred within the subterranean chambers.
What is the evidence for that?
There's some erosion patterns. Which match some sort of gas being present.
This is one reason why we have to get John to Egypt, to get him down in the subterranean chamber, because he believes there's evidence of gas erosion, which would establish that the gases were produced in the subterranean chamber.
How do you recognize gas erosion on rock as opposed to water erosion?
It leaves a different pattern. If there's some sort of air bubbles or... Mm-hmm. Yes, of various forms.
So how would they separate it? How do you take water being pumped up and it's being pulsed and it's slapping against that granite? How do you go from that to separating into the two components of gas?
Well, within the subterranean chamber, there's what's a limestone environment, mm-hmm. which is highly volatile to begin with. And
how is limestone highly volatile?
It's reactive.
Oh, okay, because of its chemical composition.
Correct.
Okay.
Calcium carbonate.
Right, and combine that with, there's a tremendous velocity, fluid velocity, going against this particular medium, plus got a compression wave that's reverberating within the room, plus there's also in the rarefaction wave, the rarefaction wave is a negative pressure, and it's quite possible that would cause cavitation within the subterranean chamber on the ceiling.
So it would accumulate, the separated gases would accumulate on the ceiling?
It would accumulate in one particular spot,
mm-hmm.
which eventually it would end up in the most westerly section of the particular room. And I strongly believe that there was a small tunnel that went from the subterranean chamber to the...
And gas rises?
Yes.
So it would just naturally find its way up to the
queen's
chamber.
Right.
This is so brilliant. It's like get the materials to do the work for you.
And then
any
form of overflow in the water being perked up into the queen's chamber would run down the hallway and back down into the well shaft.
Okay. So it's self-correcting.
Right.
And self cycling.
Right.
Okay. Oh, boy. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Because we have just 2 minutes. What do you want to say in way of conclusion to this? I want to continue.
It was nice meeting Stephen today. Stephen.
Yeah.
It was. And,
nice meeting you, John.
Yeah.
This is just a further example of what's happening in the world, as you know, and on our group, the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association has a group of international scientists bringing all these theories together, and it's great if we can all get together, share this work, and get funded to do these models, because John is on the way. We want Chris to have a working model, and we can demonstrate these principles to the world.
That's what I love about independent research. So no agendas, but looking at the evidence and seeing where it honestly leads. Thank
There's
you all.
There's a lot of evidence over there to look at. Yes, there is.
Don't you wish you had that debris field, you know, these shattered burnt crystals here? And
you've been to Egypt, Laura. You've seen the evidence. And
with my unaided, educated eye, I could see that, yeah.
You know, I should mention, too, that in January, Stephen and I will be... attending a conference in Cairo and leading a tour. So we'll be showing folks the evidence and actually demonstrating some of the technologies of the ancient Egyptians in terms of how they created such precise objects.
Well, exciting research. Thank you. And who knows, we may end up with some form of alternative energy that could be useful today and replace fossil fuels. Why not take the wisdom of the ancient and apply it today where we can and make the world a better place? That's one of the intriguing factors to this, not just to understand our ancients and how sophisticated they were and how brilliant they were, but also to have some insight into how we can work with nature for our own enhancement and that of the rest of the planet. Thank you so much. That was Stephen Mailer and